Each of these conditions has a significant genetic component, and their symptoms manifest early in life. We know that they not only raise mortality rates and reduce one's chances of having children, but also the life expectancy and fertility of those offspring. Natural selection is usually ruthlessly efficient at weeding out genes that compromise an organism's chances of survival and reproduction, and it makes no exception for us. Evolutionary theory therefore predicts that genes like the ones that predispose people to develop mental illnesses are less likely to be passed to subsequent generations and will quickly disappear. So why are mental illnesses still with us? It is easy enough to explain the persistence of rare genes behind debilitating disorders such as Huntington's disease that strike when people are approaching middle age, long after they have had children and unwittingly passed them to the next generation. But mental illnesses are usually diagnosed in our teenage years, 20s or early 30s. In other words, during the peak reproductive years. There can be little doubt that these conditions diminish patients' reproductive fitness. Research suggests that the most widespread psychiatric conditions have a moderate but significant effect on fertility, whereas the rarer disorders have a very large effect. The lifetime prevalence of anxiety disorders, for example, is around 30%. Their average age of onset is 11, and the fertility of people with these conditions is 10% less than the average for the total population. At the other end of the scale, schizophrenia is diagnosed in just under 1 in every 100 people. Its signs generally come to the notice of doctors when patients are in their early 20s, and fertility is reduced by 60% on average. Estimates of the lifetime incidence of major depression vary enormously, from 20% to 50%. Average age of onset is somewhere between the mid-20s and early 30s, and the condition reduces fertility by about 10% overall. The persistence of mental illnesses in human populations could easily be explained away if they were caused by some widespread environmental factor, such as poor diet, overcrowding, or pollution, but they have a substantial genetic component. Studies that compare identical and non-identical twins estimate that for bipolar depression and schizophrenia, around 80% of the variation in the risk of developing these illnesses can be explained by genes, and only 20% by the environment. For depression and anxiety disorders, around 40% and 30% respectively of the variation in risk is down to genetic factors. So far, however, despite sweeping the genomes of tens of thousands of people, scientists have collared only a handful of genes that increase the likelihood of any mental illness, and each one accounts for only a fraction of the overall risk. This suggests that common mental illnesses such as depression and anxiety are caused by a complex interaction between lots of very common genes, each with a tiny individual effect, and environmental influences. As you can imagine, the persistence of highly heritable mental illnesses that strike in early adulthood, not only reducing patients' fertility but also that of their offspring, has had the psychiatrists scratching their heads. One explanation is that while the many gene variants responsible harm the reproductive chances of patients themselves, in the lower doses found among their siblings they may actually increase fertility. In genetics, this is known as balancing selection. In medicine, the classic example is the gene for sickle cell anemia. If you inherit a copy of this gene from only one of your parents, it will protect you from infection by the malaria parasite. But if you inherit one copy from each parent, your red blood cells twist into a rigid sickle shape, causing severe pain and increasing the risk of stroke. This explains why the sickle cell gene and the disease it causes persist in sub-Saharan Africa, where malaria is rife. A variant of balancing selection known as the cliff-edge hypothesis proposes that a particular genetic trait is beneficial in reproductive terms, but only up to a point, beyond which it is harmful. One beneficial trait that has long been associated with mental illness is creativity. According to the cliff-edge hypothesis, a little extra creativity as a result of being dealt a particular genetic hand increases one's reproductive success, whereas too much of the same trait is deleterious. The roll call of famous writers, performers, and artists who have been afflicted by mental illness is certainly very long. Aristotle claimed that no great genius has ever existed without a strain of madness, and there is now evidence that the ancient Greek philosopher, no creative slouch himself, was onto something. A study of 300,000 people with severe mental disorders in Sweden found that those with bipolar disorder and the healthy siblings of patients with either bipolar or schizophrenia were more likely to be involved in creative professions, defined in this study as having an artistic or scientific occupation. Could one of the cliff-edge benefits of enhanced creativity be increased reproductive success? If so, in siblings, this would compensate for the reduced fertility of patients themselves and help explain why the genes responsible for mental illness are so persistent. There is some evidence this may be the case. A questionnaire-based study of 425 adults in Britain asked them about their creative output and the number of steady relationships and sexual partners they had had since they were 18. It also measured schizotypy, four personality dimensions that are characteristic of people who have been diagnosed as having a mental illness, but are also found in varying degrees throughout the population. Unusual perceptual and cognitive experiences such as hallucinations and magical thinking. Difficulties with attention and concentration. Lack of enjoyment and social withdrawal. And nonconformity, including unstable moods and behavior, disregard of rules and violence or recklessness. People who scored high on unusual experiences were more likely to be poets or artists, and this in turn appeared to increase their mating success. Nonconformity was also associated with greater mating success. Lack of enjoyment and social withdrawal, however, tended to decrease both creative activity and mating success. So the unusual experiences often associated with mental illness could make people more creative, which in turn works as a uniquely human form of mating display to increase reproductive success. But there may be a limit to these benefits beyond which the experiences have a profoundly negative effect. It tips fertility over a cliff edge. A study that scoured the medical records of 2.3 million people living in Sweden, accumulated over a 20-year period, found that patients diagnosed with a wide range of mental illnesses had significantly fewer children than average. However, there was also some balancing selection, because the siblings of patients with depression and substance abuse disorders had significantly more children than average, which in the case of depression was more than enough to make up for the reduced fecundity of their less fortunate brothers and sisters. Nevertheless, gene-environment interactions may also play an important role. For example, you may benefit from being highly creative if you were born into a wealthy, supportive family, but there could be negative consequences if you were born into less favorable circumstances. We are still a long way from finding a definitive solution to the puzzle of why mental illnesses remain so prevalent. Creativity is almost certainly only a small part of the story. The figures suggest that other cliff-edge factors must also be contributing. Language ability may be an important one, as I will explain shortly. But it seems likely that the large number of common genes that make people vulnerable to anxiety and depression, and even more so if they experienced trauma, abuse, or deprivation in childhood, or face adverse conditions during adulthood, are preserved because they confer advantages in smaller doses and under more favourable circumstances. The picture is a little more complicated for mental illnesses that have the biggest effect on fertility, such as bipolar disorder and schizophrenia. The Swedish researchers found that the sisters of patients with these diagnoses did have more children than average, but this boost was not enough to compensate for their siblings' reduced mating success. In contrast to depression and anxiety, these rarer illnesses may persist not only through balancing selection, but also because they are partly caused by random mutations in parents' or grandparents' DNA, particularly in the sperm of older fathers. There is good evidence that the children of older men have a higher risk of developing schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. It is worth remembering, though, that even in these conditions, there is still plenty of scope for gene-environment interactions that make them more or less likely to develop. In the very first sentence of this book, I quoted Ajahn Amaro, the abbot of Amaravati Buddhist Monastery in the UK, who during my brief stay as a guest there in 2014, dropped into our conversation the idea that we are all mentally ill. He was not talking about the official diagnoses you can find by thumbing through the Psychiatrist Bible, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, but our shared vulnerability to the three psychological poisons that Buddhists believe to be the root cause of human suffering: craving, aversion, and delusion. This isn't to deny the ample evidence that some people are more vulnerable than others to mental suffering as a result of their genes and circumstances. Rather, it focuses on our common inheritance as a species, the factors in our shared psychological makeup that predispose all of us to addiction, anxiety, depression, and even psychosis if we have the misfortune to experience difficult conditions while growing up, or when faced with challenging situations later in life, such as physical illness, a relationship breakup, becoming unemployed, or losing a loved one. In tune with this Buddhist perspective, many psychiatrists have been coming to the conclusion that clear-cut diagnoses such as generalized anxiety disorder, depression, bipolar disorder, and schizophrenia are a convenient fiction. In reality, the distinctions between these conditions are blurred, and their constituent symptoms are widespread in the general population. So, for example, people with severe depression often experience delusions and hallucinations, and those with an anxiety disorder are likely to have some symptoms of paranoia and be more prone to depression. Patients who have been diagnosed as having bipolar disorder or schizophrenia also have symptoms in common. As a result of this lack of clear boundaries, a single patient might be given several different diagnostic labels. At the same time, geneticists and neuroscientists have failed to find any justification for assigning people to distinct categories because the overlap between them in terms of genetics, brain structure and function is so great. It makes more sense to consider mental illness as a collection of shared symptoms that vary in severity on a continuum with everyday experiences in the general population. A study published in 2013, based on interviews conducted by the UK's Office for National Statistics and Standard Psychiatric Questionnaires, found that 20 to 30% of adults continually worry that certain people are against them and might exploit or hurt them. One in six people spend a lot of time wondering whether they can trust their friends or work colleagues. About 10% sometimes feel others are watching them, staring at them, deliberately acting to harm them or trying to control their thoughts. At the far end of this continuum, 1.8% fear there are plots afoot to cause them serious harm or injury. If we take the rates of endorsement of paranoid items in our study at face value, the researchers conclude, they suggest that paranoia is so common as to be almost normal. A little paranoia is a good thing, of course, because wariness about the intentions of others, particularly strangers, is prudent. If someone phoned you out of the blue claiming to be from your bank and asked for your security details, you would be wise to refuse. Paranoia only becomes a problem when it is unrelated to reality, causes distress, and interferes with normal, everyday functions. In keeping with the cliff-edge hypothesis, to exercise a little caution around other people is adaptive, whereas paranoid delusions about them may lead to social isolation and plunge the most vulnerable into mental illness. The same is true of those other two poisons of the mind singled out by Buddhism, craving and aversion. Appetites of all kinds are a biological necessity, but in excess they lead to clogged arteries, dependency and addiction. Anger and aversion might once have made all the difference in a primitive fight for survival, but they are counterproductive in the modern world where compassion, compromise, and cooperation are more beneficial for everybody concerned. Thinking about Ajahn Amaro's words, I was reminded of a conversation between Alice and the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland. "What sort of people live about here?" "In that direction," the cat said, waving the right paw round, "lives a hatter. And in that direction," waving the other paw, "lives a March hare. Visit either you like. They're both mad." "But I don't want to go among mad people," Alice remarked.
"Oh, you can't help that," said the cat. "We're all mad here. I'm mad. You're mad."
"How do you know I'm mad?" said Alice.
"You must be," said the cat, "or you wouldn't have come here."
You probably remember the scene that follows. Alice chances upon the Mad Hatter, March Hare and Dormouse having a tea party. When she joins them, the Hatter and March Hare gleefully expose the logical flaws in everything she says. Their creator, the Victorian mathematician Lewis Carroll, had the kind of analytical, scientific mind that relished this sort of exercise. Like the Hatter and March Hare, we too have the capacity for unassailable logic. But like them, we are prone to moments of madness when we do something aggressive, irrational, and perhaps even a little silly, like trying to stuff a sleepy dormouse into a teapot. It seems mental illnesses are not triggered by a smattering of rare genes carried by an unfortunate few. If they were, the conditions would be less widespread and we would probably have developed a set of diagnostic genetic tests by now. Rather, they are caused by a multitude of common genes interacting in complex ways with each other and the environment. These genes are either recent mutations or are maintained by balancing selection. No other animal species, even the smart ones, suffers from debilitating mental illnesses. They certainly don't commit suicide. Sacrificing oneself for the colony or for one's offspring isn't the same thing at all. At what point in our evolution did things start to go so wrong? Consider a hunter-gatherer on the hostile African savanna. According to Herbert Benson, the Boston cardiologist we met in the second chapter, who discovered the relaxation response, the physiological flip side of the fight-or-flight response, our vulnerability to stress arises from the way the human mind strings out thoughts about past or future threats. It's not just having a saber-toothed tiger in front of you, it's the thought of the saber-toothed tiger, he told me. Other prey animals fear predators as much as our hunter-gathering ancestors must have and run for their lives when under threat. But they don't obsess about predators when they are no longer there or if they have already made a kill. Impala don't suffer from sleepless nights or gnaw their hooves the way we humans chew our nails. When the danger has passed, they quickly go back to eating the grass. It's hard to tell, but they do seem the happier for it. Nevertheless, There remain questions about how and why our species became such inveterate worriers and brooders, not to mention our tendency for paranoid delusions. To explain these behaviours, we may have to travel back in time some 6 million years ago to the chimp-like creatures I introduced at the start of this chapter. Fossil remains of Aurorin tugenensis were discovered in the Tugen Hills in 2000 and may be the earliest evidence of bipedalism in a human ancestor. Another weaker contender for this title is Sahelanthropus chadensis, whose skull was found in Taurus Menala in Chad. The remains include pieces of femur that suggest Aurorin was adapted for walking upright on two legs, while other features indicate it still spent much of its time up trees. We will probably never know for certain whether Aurorin is an ancestor of Australopithecines, the hominins that preceded the appearance of our own genus, Homo, about 1.8 million years ago, though some researchers claim that the bones point that way. Regardless of any difficulty reconstructing the exact evolutionary route our ancestors took when they stood up and walked on their hind legs, it would eventually have profound repercussions. The immediate advantage for apes on foraging expeditions in the open may have been the ability to see where they were going in long grass and spot predators from a distance. On the rare occasions when modern chimps venture out into the savannah, they sometimes stand up on two legs to get a better view. A variety of advantages of walking upright all the time have been proposed. These include the ability to travel great distances efficiently, prevent overheating by exposing a smaller surface area of the body to the midday sun, and freeing the hands to carry provisions, tools, and crude weapons such as stones and spears, and throw those projectiles with deadly accuracy. But perhaps the most far-reaching advantage, the one that would eventually lead to the extraordinary abilities that define our species, was to free the hands for communication. As I will explain shortly, we may have paid a high price for this breakthrough. According to psychologist Michael Corballis, who studies the evolution of language at the University of Auckland in New Zealand, crude hand signals like the one I envisaged being used by the lookout ape to signal safety at the start of this chapter evolved over the course of millions of years into a sophisticated sign language that would one day lead to the emergence of vocal language. Corballis and others have argued strongly against the idea that spoken language appeared almost out of nowhere in an isolated Big Bang moment within the past 100,000 years as a result of chance genetic mutation in a single individual. Evolution tends to inch forward in tiny incremental steps rather than in huge leaps. Changes build one on top of another over eons, like a stalagmite growing on the floor of a cave splashed by countless drops of water. Corballis believes that the neural hardware required for a grammatical language evolved over millions of years in the service of an increasingly sophisticated communication system involving hand gestures and facial expressions, perhaps supplemented with oral clicks, like those still used by the Hadza and San groups in Africa. He cites several lines of supporting evidence, including the fact that our cousins, the chimpanzees and bonobos, can be trained to communicate using abstract symbols. Primatologist Sue Savage-Rumbaugh successfully taught a bonobo called Kanzi to use 256 symbols on a keyboard denoting objects and actions, and the ape himself devised several hand gestures to supplement them. Even in the wild, chimpanzees have a repertoire of manual gestures that they can use flexibly to communicate depending on the context. There is no evidence that non-human apes can learn grammatical rules in order to string together words to make complex sentences. But the ability of our nearest relatives to recognize and use symbols suggests that our common ancestor had the neural wherewithal to develop a simple, symbolic language that became increasingly sophisticated over time. Corballis points out that modern sign languages are now recognized as having all the complexity and scope of speech. There are also clues in our brains that spoken language evolved from sign language. In the 1990s, neuroscientists at the University of Parma in Italy discovered a type of nerve cell in the brains of macaques that they called mirror neurons, because they not only fired when a monkey made an intentional movement of its hand, but also when it saw one of its fellows or even a human make the same movement. These mirror neurons are in the monkey's frontal lobe at a spot that corresponds precisely to a region in the left hemisphere of the human brain, known as Broca's area, which is not only closely involved in speech, but also in controlling complex hand movements. This has led Corballis to suggest that at some point during our evolution, vocal language was incorporated into a system that had already evolved for communication using manual gestures. It is at this point that the evolutionary stories of mental illness and language come together, because mirror neurons are now considered part of a more extensive mirror system in the human brain that overlaps with much of the default mode network, the constellation of regions that light up whenever we are not engaged in an external task. As we have seen in previous chapters, the network is intimately involved when we reflect about our place in the social world, our past experiences, and our future plans. But it has also been implicated in a range of mental illnesses. The default network is the brain's simulator. It not only creates our sense of self, but also builds a representation of other people's minds, a mirror version of their world, allowing us to see things from their perspective and intuit their beliefs, thoughts, and intentions. Theory of mind. And of course, the default network is also the mental time machine we use to rewind into the past and fast forward into the future. Mental time travel and theory of mind are indispensable for complex language. Whether speaking or signing, language allows us to pass on information about things that have already happened or things that might happen. A mutual understanding of each other's perspectives, what the other person knows and what they don't know, and your shared beliefs, further enhances the effectiveness of communication. The subtleties of metaphor, irony, and sarcasm, which work only if at least some of the people with whom you're communicating know not to take your words literally, would be impossible without theory of mind. It therefore makes sense to envisage language and the default mode developing in lockstep over the course of human evolution as our mental simulations became increasingly powerful, allowing us to muse about the past, speculate about the future, and infer the mental states of others. So language became the very stuff of thought. We were now talking to ourselves, providing a running internal commentary of everything that happened and might happen. Perhaps, unsurprisingly, there is ample evidence that the default mode, which facilitates language, is also involved in mental illness. People with depression appear to have trouble suppressing the default mode in order to focus on the task at hand. This manifests as a tendency to slip into rumination or brooding, in other words, excessive negative self-referential thought that can interfere with everyday activities. Research suggests that even patients in remission from depression still struggle to control the default mode, which may explain their greater cognitive reactivity. The way small bursts of sadness that other people shrug off instead trigger the streams of negative thought that can lead to a relapse. Other studies have implicated a failure to regulate the default mode in anxiety disorders and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. Finally, there is solid evidence that control of the network is impaired in patients with schizophrenia and bipolar disorder. Because of the default mode's central role in self-referential thinking and inferring the mental states of others, when it runs out of control, this may blur the distinction between internal thoughts and external stimuli, triggering hallucinations and promoting paranoia about the intentions of others. The link between the default mode, language, and mental illness is a dangerously intimate one. In the study of creativity in Sweden described above, accountants were no more likely than controls, and in some cases even less likely, to suffer from the mental illnesses investigated, whereas authors were twice as likely as controls to have schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. They were also more likely to be diagnosed with depression, anxiety disorders, alcohol and drug abuse, and to take their own lives. A follow-up study that analyzed the records of more than 1 million Swedish people confirmed these findings. So it seems language is a dangerous mistress. A love of numbers might make for a happier life. The affair may have started innocently enough, with perhaps a few dozen manual gestures employed by our ape forebears to exchange information among themselves some 6 million years ago. Things only began to get out of hand comparatively recently, but all along, the evolutionary impetus for these improvements in communication was social cohesion. Evolutionary psychologist Robin Dunbar has discovered that the number of individuals in primate social groups increases in direct proportion to the size of the orbitofrontal cortex, so-called because it is located immediately above the orbits of the eye sockets. See Figure 6 on the enhancement. This extends into the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, the area we first encountered in Chapter 5, The Man Who Disappeared, as an integral part of the brain's self-app, which not only simulates our sense of having a solid, unchanging self, but also the perspectives of other people. Dunbar found that the relative size of a primate's orbitofrontal cortex predicts the sophistication of its theory of mind or mentalizing abilities. In other words, how good it is at inferring the viewpoints of others. To survive in a complex social group, an individual needs to keep track not only of the constantly shifting social relationships between itself and fellow members of its group, but also those between other group members. Dunbar went on to discover that a primate species' ability to manage these simulations in turn predicts the maximum size of its social groups, because if there are too many individuals for their mentalizing abilities to manage, social cohesion breaks down. This became known as the social brain hypothesis. Dunbar has used it to estimate the group sizes of hominins from the dimensions of their fossilized skulls. We know that being part of a gang would have been vital for their survival on the savannah, helping to protect against predation and attacks from rival groups. It would also become indispensable for hunting success. Dunbar's research suggests that as a result of these selection pressures over millions of years, hominins organized themselves into ever larger social groups. The skulls of the many species of Australopithecine that thrived in Africa from around 4 million years ago indicate the trend in brain size, and group size was slowly upward. The pace picked up about 1.8 million years ago with the appearance of the first representative of our own genus, Homo ergaster, during the early Pleistocene, and accelerated rapidly about 500,000 years ago with the emergence of archaic humans such as Homo heidelbergensis. Anatomically modern humans, Homo sapiens, came on the scene around 200,000 years ago, and from the volume of our orbitofrontal cortex and the mentalizing abilities it facilitates, Dunbar predicts that the maximum group size of our species is around 150 people. The challenge for evolutionary psychologists like Dunbar is to explain how hominins found the time and energy to hold their increasingly large social groups together. Most primates keep the peace and ensure social cohesion through mutual grooming, but this is time-consuming, and so there is a limit to the number of individuals one can groom while still having enough time during daylight hours for traveling and foraging. Dunbar proposes that our hominin ancestors first maintained cohesion in their burgeoning groups by making extra time for grooming through other savings, such as anatomical adaptations for more efficient long-distance walking and changes in diet to more energy-rich foods, including tubers. Much later, he says, there would be singing, dancing and laughter, better tools and weapons, more meat, fire and cooking. But vocal language would eventually become the most effective social glue of all. Estimates of when speech emerged vary enormously at anything from 500,000 to 50,000 years ago, but finally there would come storytelling, gossip, rhetoric, and religion, the mixed blessings of spoken language that still hold much of the modern social world together. As we have seen, language, mental time travel, sophisticated mentalizing abilities and self-referential thought come as a package courtesy of the brain's default mode network. The organization of this network in humans sets us apart from other apes, making possible impressive feats of creativity, forward planning, and problem solving. It glues our unusually large social groups together by allowing us to communicate and infer the mental states of others to a degree unprecedented among primates. Having a highly sensitive theory of mind has some odd effects, though, some entertaining and others less so. Our minds are tuned to see the semblance of human faces everywhere we look, even in punctuation. Pieces of toast and random cloud formations. In a house where I lived as a child, every night I saw the devil leering down at me from the curtains of my bedroom, though in the morning all I could see were flowers and foliage. We have a tendency to infer conscious agency where there is none. A puppeteer I sometimes watch performing in Leicester Square in central London makes a grinning skeleton puppet dance to recordings of popular songs. A particularly poignant favourite is Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy. He stands over the skeleton, pulling its strings in plain sight of the spectators, but his skill is such that one is drawn into the amusing but slightly creepy illusion. Why else would we stop and watch, spellbound? This is what an overactive theory of mind will do for an ape. It's little wonder that wherever our ancestors looked, they saw ghosts, spirits, and gods. We like to think we are above such delusions. But if you have ever worked in an office, you will have heard colleagues curse their computers as if a ghost in the machine were deliberately trying to thwart them. You have probably done some of the cursing yourself. This isn't considered unusual behavior, but under the extreme stress of situations such as sleep deprivation or solitary confinement, people routinely start to experience the kind of delusions and hallucinations popularly supposed to be the exclusive preserve of the mentally ill. As we saw in Chapter 5, The Man Who Disappeared, we use the same neural equipment to simulate the mental states of others that we use to simulate our sense of selfhood. So this was the evolutionary bargain our species struck in exchange for the benefits of language, mental time travel, and theory of mind. The self was born on the African savannah. It seems humans intuited long ago that something had gone awry in their distant past and that it had something to do with the origins of self-consciousness. They tried to make sense of it through the legends and religious stories they told themselves. Most famously, the Abrahamic religions traced the origins of our predicament to the Garden of Eden, where Adam and Eve were said to have eaten forbidden fruit from the tree of knowledge. And the eyes of them both were opened, and they knew that they were naked. They concluded that humanity had been much happier before this abrupt fall from grace. The 14th century Christian contemplative who wrote The Cloud of Unknowing perceptively laid the blame on the disordered mental simulations that now plagued the untrained human mind. Imagination is the faculty by which we form images of all absent and present things, and both it and the matter on which it works are contained by consciousness. Before humanity sinned, imagination was so obedient to reason, to which it is, as it were, a servant, that it never supplied it with any disordered image of a bodily object or any delusion of a spiritual object. But now it is not so. Unless it is controlled by the light of grace in the reason, it will never cease, asleep or awake, to form alien and disordered images of bodily objects, or else some delusion or other which is nothing but a bodily conception of something spiritual, or a spiritual conception of something bodily. This is always deceptive and false and associated with error. In those who are newly turned from the world to devotions, this disobedience of the imagination can be clearly recognized when they are praying. For until the time comes when the imagination is to a great extent controlled by the light of grace in the reason, as it is by continual meditation on spiritual matters such as their own sinfulness, the passion, the kindness of our Lord God, and many other similar topics, they are quite unable to set aside the strange and alien thoughts, delusions, and images that are supplied and imprinted in their minds by the light and ingenuity of imagination. All this disobedience is the punishment for original sin. An alternative explanation can be found in the distant evolutionary past of the human lineage. The Tugen Hills of Kenya, where the remains of Aurorin were uncovered, and Lake Turkana in Tanzania, where several hominin species, including Homo ergaster, have been found, don't hold the same pull for the world's tourists as the Great Pyramids or Stonehenge, or for that matter, Bodh Gaya or Bethlehem. But the sites where the petrified bones of our ancestors were unearthed act as bookmarks for some fascinating chapters in the story of our species. I believe they speak to who we are just as powerfully as do those great ancient monuments to human ingenuity and creativity. Our evolution into such highly sociable, talkative creatures is what set us apart from the other apes and our distant hominin ancestors, allowing us to live harmoniously in large, complex social groups. But it also leaves us vulnerable to the dangers of disengaging from the reality of the present moment and succumbing to self-referential thoughts, rumination, worry, and paranoia. It is difficult to escape the conclusion that we have evolved into an ape that takes things personally. If our brains were computers, we would demand an upgrade of the operating system. As we'll explore in the next chapter, it seems that meditation, though not a quick fix, might help to debug the human mind, correcting the flaws that have accumulated in the course of its evolution. Chapter 10. Wonderful and Marvelous. Make it thy business to know thyself, which is the most difficult lesson in the world. Miguel de Cervantes, Don Quixote de la Mancha. Translated by Peter Motteux. At one time the Buddha was living at a monastery in Jetta Grove near the city of Savatthi on the Ganges plain. After returning from their alms rounds and eating their meal, a number of the monks were chatting in the assembly hall when their conversation turned to the miraculous things they had heard about him, such as how he seemed to know everything about the Buddhas of old, their names, their clans, the depth of their concentration during meditation, which ones attained the deathless state of Nibbana, Nirvana. Ananda, the Buddha's faithful attendant, was about to tell them what he had heard. Friends, Tathagatas, perfectly enlightened, selfless beings, have wonderful and marvelous qualities. When the Buddha himself walked in and took his seat, Ananda fell silent. What were you talking about? The Buddha inquired. We were discussing your wonderful and marvelous qualities, sir, they replied rather sheepishly. K. Carry on, Ananda, said the Buddha. Tell them about the Tathagata's wonderful and marvellous qualities. Ananda cleared his throat.
Well, I have heard it said that when the Blessed One descended from heaven into his mother's womb, a great immeasurable light surpassing the splendour of the gods appeared, so that even the abysmal places of utter darkness, where the light from the moon and the sun had never reached, became brilliantly lit, and the 10,000-fold world system shook and quaked and trembled. I have heard this is one of the wonderful and marvellous qualities of the Blessed One.
Go on.
Ahem. And the Blessed One's mother became perfect in every virtue. No kind of sickness afflicted her during pregnancy. She was blissful and free from bodily fatigue. She carried him for 10 months rather than the usual 9. She gave birth standing up. 4 devas caught him, and when the Blessed One came forth from his mother's womb, he was completely unsullied. Even so, 2 jets of water poured down from the sky, one cool and one warm, to wash the Blessed One and his mother. Lotus flowers bloomed all around as the Blessed One put his foot on the ground for the first time and walked.
So would you like to hear another wonderful and marvellous quality of the Tathagata? The Buddha asked. Everyone nodded enthusiastically. Yes, please.
There followed a long pause, and when he finally spoke, it was with the faintest hint of a smile. When a feeling arises in the mind of the Tathagata, he knows this is a feeling. When a feeling abides in his mind, and when a feeling fades away, he knows this is a feeling abiding, and this is a feeling fading away. When a perception arises in the mind of the Tathagata, he knows this is a perception. When a perception abides in his mind, and when a perception fades away, he knows this is a perception abiding and fading away. When a thought arises in the mind of the Tathagata, he knows this is a thought arising. When a thought abides in his mind and fades away, he knows this is a thought abiding and fading away. This, too, is a wonderful and marvellous quality of the Tathagata. While the Buddhist scriptures are replete with breathless descriptions of supernatural occurrences, the Buddha continually tried to refocus his followers' attention on the insights he had gained into how to cultivate a healthy mind, which he believed to be infinitely more important than any magical tale. During my stay at the monastery, Abbot Ajahn Amaro told me the story outlined above. What he points to here is that all that stuff about lotus flowers and devas doesn't really help you very much, said the monk. What is really amazing, the real miracle, is that you can watch your own mind. Psychologists call this metacognition, the ability to think about thought, objectively reviewing feelings, perceptions, ideas, and beliefs as they arise in the mind. Humans are almost certainly the only species that can do this. One of the aims of meditation is to break the habit of identifying with the contents of our stream of consciousness, clutching at them as if they defined us, and instead view them as discrete mental events that we can watch as they arise, linger for a while, and then fade. Metacognition is what allows you to make silent, non-judgmental observations during meditation, and, more importantly, life in general, such as, there is calm, or there is frustration, as opposed to, I am so frustrated right now. This leads to an understanding of how the contents of the mind ebb and flow. When Buddhists talk about the insights that arise from mindfulness, this is one of them. This ancient concept has close parallels in psychiatry, because one of the common factors known to predispose people to a range of mental illnesses, alongside things like adverse experiences in childhood and low self-esteem, is an inability to step back and review thoughts and feelings objectively. Failure to self-regulate in this way
is implicated in a wide range of behavioural and psychological problems, including poor school performance, ADHD, anxiety, depression, and drug abuse. Metacognition, by contrast, allows us to weigh our options and then consciously decide our behaviour rather than acting on impulse. Psychotherapies such as cognitive behavioural therapy, CBT, and mindfulness-based programs have been explicitly designed to nurture metacognitive skills. For example, the Mindfulness in Schools project, pioneered by the Oxford Mindfulness Centre in the UK, includes an exercise in which teenagers are encouraged to visualise each thought or feeling as a bus drawing up alongside a bus stop. They have a choice whether to step on board, and even if they get on the bus only to discover later that it's not going their way, they can always hop off at the next stop. There is nothing magical about metacognition, though it is certainly a wonderful and marvellous ability. In the previous chapter, I introduced the idea that our ancestors ganged together in increasingly large social groups in order to protect themselves from predators and rival groups on the African savanna and hunt more effectively. Failure to do so would have meant an early death and the extinction of their genes. Over millions of years, these selective pressures appear to have changed our brains to make us the sociable animals we are today, steadily improving our mentalizing abilities and facilitating the emergence of complex language and mental time travel. We became experts at forming strategic alliances and playing the games of deception and self-promotion needed to get our own way in a large group of individuals with competing needs. But there was another selective pressure operating, because to rub along harmoniously with our fellow apes and prevent these larger groups from fracturing, it would also become essential to develop a measure of self-restraint, the wisdom to know when to back down in a conflict or sacrifice selfish needs for those of the group as a whole. We learned how to be patient and delay our own gratification for another day. This conscious self-restraint would have been impossible without metacognition. Scientists are still figuring out how the human brain performs this impressive feat of introspection. But the chances are that as a relatively new addition in our mental toolbox, metacognition is facilitated by some of the most recently evolved parts of the prefrontal cortex. The brains of highly experienced meditators may offer some clues, because observing the contents of the mind is fundamental to meditation practice. We know that the brain is plastic. Regions that are involved in acquiring a new skill change over time, rather like a muscle bulking up with repeated use. So areas essential for metacognition might be expected to look different in meditators compared with non-meditators. In 2005, when neuroscientist Sara Lazar at Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston and her colleagues scanned the brains of people who had spent around 6 hours practicing insight meditation every week for the previous 10 years or so, they discovered something remarkable. The thickness of the cortex is known to decline with increasing age, particularly in the frontal lobe. But a specific part of these veteran meditators' orbitofrontal cortex appeared to be defying this trend. This region of the brain was just as thick in 40 to 50-year-old meditators as it was in 20-something meditators and control subjects who had never meditated. Subsequent research by other neuroscientists has borne out these findings. The region in question is known as Brodmann Area 10, and it may be an important node in a metacognitive network that allows us to observe the emotional currents of our minds and decide whether we want to swim against them or allow ourselves to be swept along. Brodmann Area 10 is the farthest outpost of the orbitofrontal cortex. See Figure 7 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook, which, as we saw in the previous chapter, plays a crucial role in mentalizing ability, also known as theory of mind, the capacity to put oneself in other people's shoes, and see the world from their perspective. A vital skill for social cognition and language. Recall that the overall volume of the orbitofrontal cortex correlates very closely with the maximum size of a primate social group, and that it has expanded enormously over the course of human evolution. So it's intriguing to discover that Area 10 has been emerging as a key player in the neuroscience of meditation in recent years. In 2014, a team of psychologists led by Kieran Fox at the University of British Columbia in Canada